Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios in a heat wave in the east, and I don't know how it is out west, transmitting across the internet. This is episode 69 of Registry Matters. Larry, what's up?
Well, I'm just having a great time. We're not having a heat wave. It's beautiful and nice, but there's no heat. It's like a 60-degree day. Very, very beautiful.
Everyone that I have seen that has a convertible is driving around with the top down, and they are loving life. Low humidity, and it's like in the mid-70s. It's a stellar day.
It sounds fantastic. I wish I could be down where they grow the peaches and the peanuts.
So why don't you tell us a little story about where people work and how much decision they have in that process of deciding how their work conditions are?
Well, that comes from my home state. I'm working as an unofficial advisor to the legal team that's involved in a challenge here. For those of you who don't know my state, we're loaded on federal facilities. We have Air Force bases, national labs. We're the biggest drain on the federal resources because we have open skies and it's great training weather. But in Otero County, which is the seat is Alamogordo, there is a dispute running between the district judges, which is the trial level court of general jurisdiction. The district judges feel that the building that they work in has become too antiquated, and they would like to force the county commission to build them a new structure. And I'm on the other side of that, which is trying to preserve the separation of powers, that the judges are not entitled to force the county commission to do anything unless they are members of the county commission. So the judges have taken the extraordinary measure of filing a writ, one of the extraordinary writs that's available called a mandamus. And a mandamus is used to force an administrative agency to do something that they are required to do and failing to do, or to prohibit them from doing something that they're not, that they don't have authority to do, that they are doing. So the judge's theory is that the county commissioners have a duty to provide them a structure to their liking. Now, they're partially right on that. The county commission does have a duty to provide them a court structure, but that's where it breaks down. It's not one to their liking. It's one to the county commission's liking, and the voters who are paying the taxes to support that structure is to their liking. And the judges are merely employees who work within the building. And it is most employees. I've been in the workforce 40 years, and I guess you've been in the workforce a few decades yourself, but when's the last time you got to specifically require that a building meet that you worked in with your standards?
Yeah, I mean, I don't get to, they do afford you sometimes, they'll let you decorate it, but you don't get to say, hey, why don't we move this building over here? We should take that building instead.
Well, they have a valid issue. The building is old. I think it goes back to the Work Progress Administration of the Depression. And it's by modern design standards, it doesn't receive traffic well. It doesn't have good ventilation. It doesn't it doesn't have separate elevators for prisoners and judges. I mean, it doesn't comport with a modern structure. But the citizens of living in Otero County, they have to pay the taxes, and they love low taxes in Otero County. And they have the capacity to impose what we call gross receipts, which most states call sales tax. They have the capacity to use some of their unused gross receipts taxing authority. They choose not to do that. And they have the authority to levy property taxes. They can increase the mill levy. And they choose not to do that. But that's their choice. So what taxes they levy on themselves is up to either the voters or the county commissioners of Otero County, and how they allocate what's been collected and how they spend it is up to them and not to the judges. The judges, the only thing they can do is work in the building they're provided. And to me, this case is a no-brainer. But the judges have taken the extraordinary step of filing a suit against the county commissioners, and it's in litigation. And then the county commissioners took the extraordinary step of filing another writ called a writ of superintendent control with the state Supreme Court, which is to prohibit a judge from taking an action that they're not allowed to do. And we talked about that in the case of Georgia. We scratched our heads wondering why Georgia didn't have such a writ. But when a court is acting outside its scope of authority, the writ of superintendent control could be used to shut down the court. So this, so the county commissioners writted the district judge who's presiding over the case and said, you don't have the authority to hear this because this is not something that's remedied, that can be remedied through a writ. It's not the, through a writ of mandamus. This is not the right vehicle. And the judges, in my view, they should seek a different occupation if they don't like their work quarters. I mean, they can come and complain to the county commissioners, which they've been doing for years, and they can appeal to the voters for higher taxes, which probably will fall on deaf ears of that part of the state. But you get to work in the building you're provided. And if you don't like that, you can perhaps seek judgeship in another part of the state, or you can move on to another line of work. But you get to work in the building that you're provided.
So two things. A, they have to stay in their lane. That's what you're really trying to say, right?
Absolutely. This is a clear separation of powers. The power to levy and collect taxes rests with the elected commissioners, and how to allocate those rests with the county commissioners. The judges do not get to decide that.
And this is then at least very similar to the places where they have people throw up signs in the yards at Halloween, and they don't have it in the statute that tells them to do that, and the sheriff just goes out and wants to do it on their own. I mean, it's an equivalent thing to that, right?
Very similar, where the sheriff is acting outside their statutory authority. But this is just even beyond that. This is separation of powers, where the judges are in the interpreting business. They're not in the legislating business unless they choose to be in that business. Now, they could try to get a judge to shut the courthouse down, saying it's substandard. And to my knowledge, I think they've tried that and failed. They haven't tried to get the judge, but they've tried to get the building authorities that oversee buildings to revoke the certificate of occupancy. They have not succeeded in doing that. But you get to work in the building you're provided, judge. And if you don't like that building, you perhaps may be able to look for another line of work. But that's the building the citizens of Volterra County are willing to provide you.
And so. I don't want to be like too tongue-in-cheek. I mean, they literally could quit and go to another county. I mean, a judge, right?
They would not be able to do a lateral transfer. They would have to be appointed to another judgeship. But when they were appointed to that judgeship, they could have told the governor, you know, I would take the job, but you've got a county courthouse that's just far too antiquated, and I would never consider working there. And if the governor can't find any people to appoint to these judgeships, that may help persuade the voters that they might be willing to impose a little bit higher levies on themselves. And that county does have some disadvantages in addition to the fact that they don't like to tax themselves. A lot of that land is under federal control, which is not on the tax rolls because of the Air Force Base. That property doesn't get taxed by the locals. So there's they have that handicap, which a lot of Western states have. You have a significant amount of land that's not on the local tax rolls.
Yeah, certainly. There is a bunch of space out there. Interesting. So, and how likely do you think it is that you'll prevail?
Well, if the arguments that are relevant are followed by the Supreme Court, I don't see any way this case can be lost. I don't see any way that the Supreme Court can allow this action to continue to move forward, which they didn't. They stopped it last week. They issued a stay of the trial that was scheduled for next week. But it's a political matter. It's not something for the judges to be involved in. So I would think that the Supreme Court will have to say that this stay is going to be made permanent, and they can't rescue themselves by using the courts to try to force the taxpayers to do what the taxpayers have chosen not to do.
Gotcha. That's interesting. And like, what kind of timeline? I mean, is this like right around the corner? Does this take 6 months to go through? Is this the ACLU thing in Michigan that takes years and decades to go through?
It'll take however long the Supreme Court wants it to take, but they'll probably order briefing, and it'll be in the coming 6 months. I would assume if they order oral argument in addition to briefing, it could take longer to schedule oral arguments. But to me, this is a sure winner. Well, it's a loser for the judges, but it's a sure winner for the team I'm on, which is the county commissioners get to decide what taxes and how to allocate them. And that's the way it has been. And that's the way it should be. That's the way I think it will be.
Interesting. Well, are you ready to move on?
Let's do it.
All right. Well, this is sort of like out of order. I was having an email conversation with what will be at the end of the show from a longtime patron, Mike, and he had a comment. He said he's still loving the podcast. Please keep it up. I've never missed one. You guys sound really clear nowadays. Also, as an FYI, I have an FYP playlist for days when I'm feeling a little less than happy about the registry and its never-ending bullshit. How about that? It's a pretty good comment.
Well, would the FYP list be the podcast?
Yeah, he's got like a playlist of his favorite episodes.
Oh, okay.
How about that?
I love it.
So yeah, thank you for that, Mike, and thank you very much for being a patron for quite a while now, and also thank you to all of our listeners and patrons in general. But we do have a voicemail message from a man named Dan. And let's see what Dan has to say.
Hi, my name is Dan Holstein. I'm a registrant here in Denver. This question is for Larry. A few weeks ago on your podcast, you had mentioned that the New Mexico registry, if you had been convicted before 1995, you wouldn't have to register there, if I understood you correctly. I did go onto their website, the New Mexico website, and they said on the website that if you were still on probation or parole during 1995, you would still have to register even if your conviction was before that. So you may have been convicted in 1985, but if you were still on probation, you would still have to register. Can you clear that up, whether I misunderstood you or if I'm misunderstanding the New Mexico website? I appreciate your time and I appreciate your show. And FPY or FYP. Thank you.
It's FYP, and it is Friendly Young People.
All right, I'd be glad to answer that one. I could have had a senior moment and misspoke, but I'm hoping that it was a misunderstanding. What he's recited is correct. The registration obligation, it originally started in 95 for those who were convicted on or after July 1 of 95. But in 2000, they came along because probation and parole had been griping for the intervening 5 years, saying that they were releasing all these people that had sexual offense convictions from custody, and that they saw it as a double standard because the people who they were releasing did not have to register, and the people that there was two groups, so they went and changed the law and made it applicable to anyone who was convicted after July 1, 95, or who was in prison as of July 1, 95, or who was on probation or serving any portion of their sentence. Which means if a person was serving one day of their sentence on or after July 1, 95, regardless of how old the conviction is, they would be covered by our version 1 of SORNA. It gets a little more complicated than that, because if your sentence lasted for another 10 years and you were still serving any portion of that sentence, so say hypothetically you had a conviction for criminality that occurred in 1980, and you got convicted in 85, and you got released on July 1st, 1995, that threw you into SORNA 1, our first version. We have three. Say you had 10 years of probation, and you got discharged on July 1, 2005, and these are all hypotheticals to illustrate the worst. You would have then transitioned into our second version of SORNA, because you would have been serving one day of your sentence as of July 1, 2005, which captured anybody who was in the system who had not totaled out and finaled out. So your registration obligations would have gone on that day from once a year for 20 years to four times a year for life. Just that one day would have made all the difference.
Right.
Those are the people who we call double whammied, but except we don't use that polite word when we're talking privately. Those are people who got doubly screwed, and there's a significant number of them who got souped up twice. They got retroactively roped in, and then they got souped up in 05 because they hadn't finished.
Jeepers. Huh. Well, that's miserable.
And then we have a third version. If you were convicted, and this truly does rest on the date of conviction, if you were convicted on or after July 1, 2013, but of the three versions, there's only one that applies where conviction date is relevant. The other dates are when you got off paper.
Let's move on to a voicemail message from Rob talking about Interstate Compact, which is definitely your area of expertise.
Hi, this is Rob calling from Pennsylvania. I very much appreciate what you guys do, both Larry and Andy. You do a wonderful job. I look forward to it every week listening to the podcast. My question that I have is basically regarding the Interstate Compact. My conviction was out of New York. I live in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is where I'm at. My understanding that you can file to get off of probation, which is what I was sentenced to, 10 years probation only. I'm in my sixth year. It's my understanding that after you serve at least half, you can put a request in to have your probation ended if everything is good with you. However, my probation officer here in PA, we have a good rapport, has submitted at my last annual report to New York that I'm in compliance and requested consideration to be released of probation. There was email back and forth between him, them requesting additional information, but nothing has been heard since. That was from a few months back. So what my question is before I go find an attorney in New York and try to do it on my own, if the process is handled through the Interstate Compact and they relieve me, that would be wonderful. But because nothing's been heard, I don't know who to contact at the Interstate Compact. If there is a Pennsylvania or in New York, or if there's a particular person to speak to regarding the status of that request. Again, I appreciate what you guys do, and FYP.
That's starting to catch on, Andy.
I'm trying.
Starting to catch on.
That's it's going to be just like Mega Dittos.
It's a great question there, and what I would start with by saying that this would not be construed as legal advice, but I don't even think it even comes close. What the process would be pretend like you're not even in Pennsylvania, because Pennsylvania has very little to do with it. Pennsylvania is mostly out of the loop. You would do exactly what you would do if you were in New York to get early termination. It's entirely up to New York. So if it were me, I would look at the court system in New York, which is one of the funkiest ones I've ever seen. So I'm not even going to try to explain it because I don't understand it. But the sentencing court generally has jurisdiction over early termination from supervision. So I would contact an attorney in New York, which is what he's trying to avoid doing, and ask him, what is the temperature on early terminations in this county? And like for Georgia, your 159 counties, we know. Those of us who are familiar with Georgia, we know that those metro counties, those five main counties, and then some of the further ones out have blended in. But we know if you're in Fulton, DeKalb, Cobb, or Clayton, that their caseloads are so horrendous that they are fairly sympathetic to people who are doing well under supervision, and they grant a lot of those petitions. So I would tell him, despite his hesitancy, to speak with an attorney back where he's convicted and find out what their temperature is. I have not seen this process work but once in my life, where a supervising, what's called a receiving state, has actively tried to get someone off supervision. I've seen it once. They normally don't want to make a recommendation, particularly for someone who might be on a sex offender registry, required to register. They don't want to stick their neck out. So what they do under the compact through ICOTS, which is the electronic transmission system, they transmit reports back to the sending state, progress reports periodically. And it would require an unusual set of circumstances where the person in the receiving state, I mean, in the sending state, getting a report from the receiving state, would initiate that process on behalf of an offender to petition for them to get removed. What I would suspect happens is these glowing reports that Pennsylvania is sending back to New York, they're being filed away, and the person, the people there in Pennsylvania are happy that Pennsylvania's got the person, and I would expect nothing to happen unless he initiates something in New York. But he needs to find out what the process is, and he needs to if he's in a county where only 10% of the people are getting let loose from supervision, and no sex offender's been terminated in anyone's memory, then it probably wouldn't be the best use of money to file that early termination. But as a general rule, where they have long terms of probation, the midway point or and beyond is a good time to apply for removal and termination from active supervision. And they may choose to meet you halfway, not terminate you from probation altogether, but to terminate all supervisory requirements and keep the 10 years intact. But you wouldn't have any reporting obligations, which would relieve the interstate compact, because the interstate compact is only valid if you have a reporting obligation. If all the fees and fines are paid and they don't want you to do anything other than live a wholesome, clean life, and they say nothing else is required of you, then the interstate compact goes out of the picture, and Pennsylvania would close supervision, even though the probation would continue in an unsupervised status. So
interesting.
Contact people in New York. Contact people who actually deal with criminal cases in that jurisdiction and find out how they treat petitions for removal. And do not try to call the Interstate Compact Office. They don't work with offenders. You can call them. They do have phones, I think. But you're not going to get anywhere by calling them. They're going to tell you that it's all up to New York. You can call. There's an Interstate Compact for Adult Offender Supervision website. They have the compact administrators' names and deputy compact administrators all listed on the homepage. But calling them is not the way the system is set up to work. It's designed to work between the states reporting to each other. And the calling the interstate compact in either office is not going to have any positive outcome in my experience.
I will add that I can't remember if it was episode one or two of the podcast where we covered interstate compacts. This is an area that you have an unbelievable amount of expertise, and you do training around your state. And I guess, do you do it in other places too, besides just in your state?
Only here, yes. It's way undertrained. I don't come anywhere near touching what there is on this complicated situation. Very few attorneys understand it. Many judges don't understand it. Prosecutors don't understand it. They treat it as an extradition rather than a retaking. They don't provide people due process. It's very complicated, but his is not that complicated. Only the New York court that sentenced him can turn him loose. Pennsylvania will be asked for input when he files that. The first thing the prosecutor and the court's going to want to see is how he's doing in Pennsylvania. What do they say about him? So those reports are going to be significant, but Pennsylvania's not going to go to New York and testify. They're going to do is look at the written reports, and they might want a psychosexual evaluation in the case of a sex offender.
Right.
I always tell people it's a good idea to plan for one of those, because New York has a risk-based system, but I suspect that if I were a prosecutor, if that's who actually, and I can't imagine it'd be anybody else, but if I were a prosecutor and I was on the other side of this petition, I would want a psychosexual eval to make sure how adamantly we were going to oppose the early termination. So I would plan to have a psychosexual eval, and I would plan to have a New York attorney if you want to get off supervision.
Gotcha. Wow. Yeah, that interstate compact thing is so complicated. And not to like rehash and beat a dead horse, but you talk about that, like the revocation hearing, and people often just like sign the waiver so they can get, I'm just going to say deported. I don't know if that's the right word. But now you go back to your sending state, but maybe your witnesses are back where you came from that could provide you with some level of witnessing and evidence to support that you're innocent of it. And now you're back home and no one's going to travel across the country. This is a nightmare. This is really a big mess.
It is a total nightmare. And since there's not enough training, and like I say, what little I do, and it's all a monetary issue, that there's not enough money to pay for the trainings that people need. And I do it pro bono, but there's a monetary issue of people not understanding. So attorneys are trying to clear cases. So the person's in custody and the jail is wanting to get rid of people, and the attorney's wanting to get this off of the public defender, who has 117 other files, wants to get this one off his table. And they tell the person, well, you ought to just go ahead and go back to New York. Well, you shouldn't go back to New York if it's a technical violation. Now, if they've charged you with a brand new crime, then you're not going to go back until you finish dealing with the criminal charges in the receiving state. But if it's technical violations, you absolutely want that probable cause hearing. And nobody understands that. So they sign a waiver of extradition when there's no extradition. You've already waived extradition. I can just about guarantee you that this questioner signed a waiver of extradition in his application and all the paperwork he signed to go to Pennsylvania. And New York already has the waiver in place. They don't need a waiver of extradition, but he's entitled to a determination of probable cause that he's violated supervision before he has to go back to New York to face a full-blown revocation. That's where the system breaks down.
Hmm. What a mess. Well, on our list of articles, this one came on my radar, and I just saw the title. I was like, okay, well, this fits right into our wheelhouse, but it's completely opposite of what it doesn't have anything to do with what we usually talk about, but this is Marcy's Law. This is from Reason Magazine. Marcy's Law is a gift to bad cops. But like, why would a cop be able to use quote unquote Marcy's Law, which my understanding is it's a way for victims to have more information about their purpose, whatever. Like, they get notified when they're coming out of prison and things like that. And almost like, I guess you could say it's almost like, when you get a judge to say that you can't be within 500 feet of a person?
That's the restraining
order. A restraining order. It feels to me it's kind of like that. But so here, a cop shoots someone on the job, and then they get to go claim Marcy's Law. So when the person's out on bond or something like that, that they don't know who shot them? This doesn't make any sense to me.
I had trouble with the article, but as best I could decipher it, it looks like that the cop is saying that he's the victim because he had to shoot the bad guy. And the bad guy, since he didn't die, is going to come after him, and he's entitled to protection under Marcy's Law because he's potentially another victim when the bad guy gets information about him. So he uses the victim privacy laws under Marcy's to claim coverage. And this is an example of how these things that go through legislative bodies go through without enough debate about nuances, because if you're not really driven to trying to come up with dredge up hypotheticals of what could happen, this is, according to the article, an unintended consequence of Marcy's Law.
Yeah, no doubt. But isn't that how a whole lot of things, are they called riders sometimes, where, okay, here's the meat and potatoes of this bill. Oh, we're going to slip this extra thing on there to just add something else, and no one's going to vote against the thing, but maybe they're voting against it for the rider. Am I making sense there?
It could be, but this could just be poorly drafted legislation, because the victim's advocates are so powerful and the other side is so weak there's very little debate. And even when there is a little bit of a debate, it's seldom robust. And it's hard to say no to these people who are crying about how mistreated they are. I mean, if you go to legislate, I mean, I would really encourage you to go when there's legislation dealing with victims, to go to the Capitol and listen. I mean, they'll tell stories, and they magically become experts because they've been a crime victim. And they tell these tear-jerking stories about how they're mistreated and how the system abuses them. And it's hard for a person who wants to have good public policy to say, well, actually, if we pass that, this is going to be the unintended consequence, and we can't have that because this is not good public policy. It's hard to tell these people that something is not good public policy.
Right. I just, you know, I remember when the election was going on here in Georgia, that there were ads that would come out against Stacey Abrams saying that she voted against some sort of bill. But when you actually like dig into it, yes, she voted against it, but she didn't vote against it for the reasons that they said that she voted against it, for a whole other multitude of reasons of quote unquote being bad public policy. But, you know, the media, left wing, right wing, they all present them. They spin it how they want to make it to demonize the other side.
Well, this Marcy's Law, of course, I don't see that this is good public policy, but it's hard to oppose it. It's got billions. I mean, it's got a billionaire behind it, and they've got millions of dollars, and they're well organized, and our side isn't.
Oh yeah. Yes, I know. You got one billionaire that's going to fund it across the entire nation practically. Well, moving along to a New York Times article, that serial sex offenders are a big problem on subways. Should they be banned for life? Tell me what you think about that right off the bat, Larry.
Well, I have a hard time banning anybody from anything for life after they've done their debt to society. It seems a little bit hypocritical. The subways are largely publicly funded, like the streets. Why don't we ban them from the streets also? Why don't we ban them for all the parks? Why don't we ban them for, I mean, the subway is an integral part of people moving in places like Philadelphia, Chicago, New York City, Washington, D.C., Atlanta to a major degree. You can't. This is out of New York. This is but this would be a contagion if they do this in New York City. All the subway operators, all the city councils will say, "Well, gee, if they can do it there, we should do it here."
Right. Everyone thinks that. Okay, so you have now identified the person as being someone creepy and icky, and they've done a sexual crime, and now they're on the subway. First of all, they aren't necessarily going to do it a second time, but if they do and they get caught, why don't you just punish them, possibly even harsher than you did the first time, to maybe the message didn't get through the first time?
Well, that is exactly what would happen. I don't know of any jurisdiction where they don't escalate punishment for repeat offenses. But this gets dangerously close to preventive detention. I mean, they're not being detained, but they're being detained from something. We don't lock people up for what they might do in this country, with rare exceptions. The threat under civil commitment laws has to be imminent, bodily, or of course, unless it's sex offender civil commitment. Then the standard is a little bit lower. But this is essentially, it's lower on the sex offender civil commitment. It's from state to state, it's more robust depending on which state where the sex offender specific civil commitment is. But in normal civil commitment for people, it's a very, very tough standard, because we're preventively putting someone away for something they might do. So it has to be pretty darn certain that they're going to do it. Well, the same thing here. If we're going to keep someone off the subway, they better be about to commit a crime. Otherwise, they should be able to use the public transportation, the streets, like everybody else.
And so two things. One, I was listening to a podcast this week, and I don't remember the show or anything, but the person had moved out of New York City out into the sticks, like up in, Syracuse or something like that. And the lady was saying that I had to get a driver's license. It was so weird. I had to learn how to drive because, people in the United States typically have no concept that you could function and live without having a car. Friend of Narsal and so forth, Emily Horowitz, she doesn't own a car. She doesn't know how to drive.
Yeah, well, it's only a few cities where, and I'm not even sure how robust Philadelphia, but you have to live in just a handful of cities where public transportation will be your only transportation. We're not big on public transportation in this country. We're big on the car.
A couple things they said in the article was, this is really starting to irritate me, common sense legislation. You could say, hey, we're going to ban aliens from coming in, we're going to do this. You can always say, well, it's just common sense legislation. It's complete garbage.
They use that term all the time.
And then right on the heels of that, then they say it's common sense legislation with the high recidivism rate of sexual offenders.
They call them predators all throughout the article.
Wow. Yeah. So anywho, so that's good times. I'm not they are extremely left leaning over there in New York.
And the left has its problems with I tell people that the left has got it wrong on many issues, and the victims carry a lot of sway with the left.
Yeah.
Somewhere, of course, I should choose not to say. I could actually say what I think it is, but it's a voting block, and it's a particular voting block. But the victims have a lot of sway. If you analyze this, I would just about bet it's victim driven.
Oh yeah,
people are saying that. Yeah, so.
Well, but we covered not exactly related, but in New York where they had a statute of limitations and it just got overturned because the left had taken over, the Dems had taken over all of the governmental offices, and they got legislation pushed through and signed. Now you have like till you're 55, I think, but prior to that, the Senate had been controlled by Republicans, and they kept that whole thing at bay and kept it from getting passed through.
That is correct. We got more support from the Republicans here on the battle that we're going to talk about later in the podcast. We didn't get enough Republican support, but we got more Republican support than we got Democratic support for trying to tame. And we did tame, like I said. We'll get to that later in the podcast.
And moving on, we got something coming out of Narsal, which is a press release. Windsor locks Connecticut repeals exclusion zones under threat of federal lawsuit. As usual, Larry, you have a slightly different take on this, at least as far as like the impact and the excitement that there should be had by it. Then can you give any background on what this is actually all about?
Well, as Reagan says.
Yes, you well. Yeah.
Well, my understanding was, wish we had Cindy here, but my understanding was the lawsuit was actually filed and that they were at the point of needing to make decisions about whether they were going to go to trial or not. So it wasn't the threat of a lawsuit. It was the threat of actually going to trial and losing the lawsuit. So the attorney that handled the case was actually not even from Connecticut, from North Carolina, Paul Dubling, who's integral to Marcell's legal efforts. And Paul filed the lawsuit, and the town chose to settle rather than risking what the legal people thought was a certain loss and having to pay a significant amount of legal fees on both sides. And they put it to the, they had a special meeting of the town of residents, and the town agreed that the majority of the town agreed that it would be better to repeal the law than conceivably lose $1 million in legal fees.
Right. Cindy is pretty awesome up there in Connecticut.
It is amazing. She's done such a good job learning how the system works and bringing people into the effort. And she's having that conference next month. Maybe we can promote it for her. Maybe we have someone listening in the New England area that would be interested in going. But yeah, they've got a conference coming up early in April.
I think Cindy listens. Cindy, if you listen, I'll reach out to you. But if you want to come on and promote your conference, feel free. Reach out to me, and then we can have a spot on for you.
She's achieved the impossible. She's got Jill Levinson coming to speak, and we've not been able to secure her presence. So she's got some kind of magic. She's the magic person who does so much research on recidivism and statistics. And
okay.
She's based in Florida, I believe.
And then the city council, or they had some vote. And to me, the vote looks pretty, I mean, it's an overwhelming vote, but it's 50-13 voted to remove the zone, but that's not necessarily so exciting.
What was the count?
Well, it's 50-13.
Yeah. And that was of the people who showed up for the council meeting, out of the 10,000 or so residents of the town.
Oh, so we had like a hundredth of a percent.
But it was considered adequate. It was like any legislative body, you know, you're making laws for the entire state, and you'll have on average bill, you may have a handful of people on something controversial for the whole state. When we had some major controversial legislation, you have 100 people show up for something that's really controversial, like the suspended background checks and the attempted repeal of the abortion ban. We have an abortion ban on the books. It's been on the books since 1969. There was an effort to try to repeal it, which failed because it got so twisted and contorted up in a misrepresentation. It was a bill permitting abortion. It was only repealing the law that prosecutes people who provide the abortions. It's been unconstitutional, but it's not to get on the abortion debate, but to say that even in that issue, you know, you only have a small number of people. I mean, it's not, so to have 50, 60 people show up in a town, it's pretty amazing, actually.
Right. Well, but this goes to one of like the core issues that we have is, out of 10,000 people, you had 63 people show up, and they have voiced their opinion and made a decision. The 10,000 people are receiving the decision of 63 people. We could collectively go to these different places, whether that be at your state capitol, but in your little local county office, whatever, and go participate.
You're absolutely right. I was at a political event today, which is referred to as ward meetings, and the parties are divided by precincts at the lowest level, and then a number of precincts make up a ward. And we have five, I believe, precincts in the ward, and for the entire ward, we had 4 voters show up for the entire ward. Now we elected,
wow.
Now here's the problem. We were trying to elect ward officials, so we needed to elect a chair of the ward, a vice chair, a secretary, and a treasurer. You can combine those. And then we were trying to elect a delegate to be on the rules committee. And we just didn't have quite enough people to spread out for the offices. And you know, that's how Saturday morning's not people's most popular time to get up and go to something political, but you know, to thousands of people that live in that ward, well over 1,000 people. I don't have many thousands, but there's four people showed up.
Well, there you go. So our democracy is ruled by dozens of people or less.
Yes. And so your point is well taken. If we showed up at city council meetings and county commission meetings and sounded intelligent, there's a good chance that we could have a far greater impact than we imagine. There's also a good chance that it would have no impact because their mind already be made up, but we don't know till we try.
And yeah.
This is an example where the threat of the adverse outcome and having substantial legal fees to pay on both sides, because they would pay Mr. Dubling's fees as well as their own. They decided that it wasn't a well-thought policy, which is a major victory for one standard of justice in Connecticut.
I suspect he's not a $50 an hour attorney.
No, but I think he offered him a very modest fee, if I read it right, of $10,000 for if they settle now. And it was going to be over six figures, possibly several six figures if they'd gone all the way through with the case.
And in which case, since it's if I'm not mistaken, it's a constitutional challenge, so they could be awarded it from a constitutional point of view?
Is that? Well, it was at federal court, so yes, he was. He would have been entitled to prevailing party attorney's fees and cost. And so that was the town attorney told him that we could lose $500,000 on each side.
And I think I was reading some comments of some people on it. They're like, man, I'll pay $1 million. We got to get these sickos out of our city. Yeah,
some people said the money should not have been relevant.
Yeah, but
and
when your roads.
Look at it that way. Yeah.
Yeah, but when you're in Connecticut and your roads are like crap because you just went through a harsh winter and you've got potholes everywhere and you're still paying back some attorney who, because you guys are a bunch of dumbasses, I think having your potholes cleaned up is probably a wiser decision.
They have potholes in Connecticut.
We're down to a state that the size of like a thumbtack and I don't know, a million people live there.
So,
all right, let's talk about prosecutors being bad.
What's new? We've talked about this for why do you people keep talking about prosecutors?
Because they hold, as we've said, they hold the keys. If we wanted to end mass incarceration tomorrow, the prosecutors would be like the first step, the first leg of the race. They could just stop bringing charges. But it's just one simple way to hold bad prosecutors accountable. This comes from the appeal that state bar organizations have the power to discipline prosecutors. We have talked about it repeatedly that prosecutors withhold evidence, and this absolutely drives me bonkers. You could be somebody that is actually innocent. The prosecutor has that evidence that says you are innocent. However, they're not releasing it. Aren't you supposed to give everything up at discovery? Isn't that part of the process that you are like required by law to give up everything you have?
Yes, that is part of the process.
Then you are literally denying someone their constitutionally protected, like, I'm not going to lock you up because you should be found innocent. Now you're taking away this person's civil liberties. They should have extreme punishment for prosecutorial misconduct.
What did I say about the world should be versus is be?
So we should record that and put it just on some sort of button that I can just press, and it'll be Larry saying, this isn't the world as it should be, it's the world as it is be.
It's unfortunate that there would be accountability that could be had through the disciplinary processes, and prosecutors or attorneys, and they're subject to actually a more stringent rule of ethical conduct to administer justice. If you look at the rules of professional conduct, there's a special rule for prosecutors, and they have a higher ethical obligation. And then if the disciplinary people don't hold them responsible, then it gets back to the voters, or the voters going to hold it, because the judges could impose sanctions for misconduct. That's also rarely done. So we've actually got three ways that we could have judges hold people accountable. Now, if they withheld something that resulted in a conviction, and a judge doesn't know about it, they can't sanction them for something they don't know about. But during the adversarial process, if the defense attorney is demanding something that the prosecution has, the judge can order it be turned over. And impose sanctions if the prosecutor does not. But the other backstop is the voters.
Right.
And as long as the voters are not outraged about this, I doubt very much it's going to change. And
certainly,
I had a good friend of mine tell me that our Department of Athletics here, which at the University of New Mexico, is in shambles. But he says, I don't care what they do. They just need to start winning games. I said, so you don't care what they do? He said, nope, as long as they win games. And I said, well, yeah, that's a really strange attitude. You know, NCAA has all these rules about recruiting and about what athletes can receive in the way of prizes and gifts. And I don't even begin to understand all the rules, but we have these rules to try to keep athletics somewhat honest. And if you're willing to break the rules, I mean, that kind of says something. But if we as society, if we're not outraged when we hear that prosecutor that engages in misconduct, there ought to be a resentment by the electorate. We elect you to be honorable and ethical. And if the ends justify the means, you're not who we want in office. But I don't think the voters look at it that way. Do you?
No, I don't. No.
So
this one really bothers me because they hold the keys. I mean, some of the articles like this really just irk me because they are completely gaming the system.
Well, it's a long read, but it's a good article.
Absolutely. Well, yeah. Is there anything from the appeal that's not a long read?
I don't recall anything. So yeah. I get prepared to read a long article, but.
And then moving on to a New York Times article, Florida Republicans push to make ex-felons pay fees before they can vote. Is this any different than a poll tax?
Maybe.
Maybe?
Maybe.
So there's a bill being presented to where, you know, so Florida in the election, like by a pretty strong majority, they voted to give felons their rights to vote back, except for murderers and sexual offenders, if I'm not mistaken. And then this imposes some sort of barrier for people that have court fees or other fines before they can get their voting rights back.
Well, the question is, the language of the citizen initiative was to they serve their sentence. The question is, since it wasn't defined what it meant, serving your sentence, that's going to be up to the courts to decide that. This group of lawmakers believes that serving the sentence includes the jail time, the probation time, the fines, and the restitution, which there's not a lot of pushback on the fines or restitution because that is something that the court sentences you to. But then there are court costs that are levied by statute. If you get convicted, that you'll pay a $20 fee for this and a $48 fee for that and a $12 facilities fee and a $10 brain injury fee. And a $300. We have a brain injury fee here, and a $300 public defender fee, and a $250 DNA fee, and all these fees can be significant. And the question is, the way I read this is whether those fees are part of the sentence. Well, maybe they are, maybe they're not. The courts will have to determine that. But that's an example of not being specific when you say serve the sentence. What did that mean? Serve your sentence means to serve all your incarceration, all of your supervision, and to pay all fines, restitution, or court-imposed fees. That could have been spelled out in the language.
And for, I don't know what the percentage is, the majority of people getting out of prison are very much like, $5 away from being homeless and bankrupt and all that. So having any, if you're not independently wealthy, if you don't have your family out there supporting you, et cetera, a $400 fee here could be exactly what's going to send you perhaps back to prison for trying to get that paid off so you can vote.
Well, it's not going to send you back to prison because they're beyond that, but it's going to prevent you from registering to vote. But I think I'd like to back up just a little bit. Since the amendment that the citizens voted on was not specific, the legislature is going to pass enabling legislation to clarify, and this proposal is to clarify that the fees imposed by the court are also part of the sentence. And I suspect, being that Florida's highly conservative and dominated by conservative lawmakers, this will probably pass to make that clear that that's a part of the sentence. And then those who disagree with it may have to go to court and say, well, no, actually, it's not a part of the sentence. And then that legislative statute will be presumed valid and constitutional, and it'll probably end up limiting some people they either go pay their fees or they won't be able to fully restore their rights. So I suspect this is going to result in disenfranchisement, depending on how much fees you owe. I mean, would you rush down to pay $3,000 worth of fees if you wanted to vote?
It would be on my list of things to do, but it wouldn't be the top priority.
You wouldn't rush out to take a loan against your whatever mechanisms you have so you could pay off the court?
It would be on my list. It probably wouldn't happen in that first cycle or two, I wouldn't think. So yeah, there's that. And we have an article from the Washington Post where this one's a lot of fun, Larry. We won't be on this one for very long, but an Oklahoma sheriff quits in protest over dangerous jail conditions. So did all the deputies, including the canine with a paw print. This is in some rural county up in the northeast corner of Oklahoma, Nowata County. And yep. It's like a dozen people, and they found, carbon monoxide in the prison. They even had their staff end up going to the hospital for carbon monoxide poisoning. And, but hey, it's okay to keep the prisoners in there, but our staff isn't going to work there. Conditions are so deplorable that they all quit.
Well, I'm going to actually defend the staff. I mean, they didn't put the defenders in there. I mean, not literally, figuratively, they did. But I mean, it's kind of like the thing. I would take this back to what I said about the judges earlier in the Otero County. The sheriff and the deputies, they can't force the county of, what would you say the name of that county was?
Nowata, I guess.
They can't force Nowata to provide them a new facility. But what they can say is, we won't work here.
Oh, so this is just like the judges.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. They don't have the capacity to decide but one thing, and that's that they won't work in the building. Now, it begs the question, if it's so bad that they won't work there, is it still fit to house any humans? I don't know. I would not venture a guess, but I'd say it's pretty remarkable in my lifetime. I go back to the Lincoln years, and I'm not aware of an entire sheriff's department walking out over jail conditions before. This is really, really.
Hey, were you present when Houdini broke out of that jail?
What year was that?
That was in the early 1900s. So I'm just wondering weren't around.
Yes. I wasn't present, but yes, I was around. So
yeah, no, I understand that the people committed some kind of offense to put them in jail, but we are the ones that should take some level of compassion that we don't put them in some place that's actually going to kill them. We didn't sentence them to death. They may have a traffic ticket and they couldn't pay the bill and they're locked up in the jail. Now they're going to get carbon monoxide poisoning.
Well, it's probably it's going to have to require a federal civil rights action. Jail litigation has gotten more complicated since the Prison Litigation Reform Act that was passed under the conservative domination in Newt's era in 96 when they passed the Anti-Terrorism Effective Death Penalty Act. They also passed a lot of bad stuff in that era. And winning jail litigation is far more difficult because they're afforded a lot more deference in terms of conditions. But if it's that bad, they might be able to get a federal judge. Federal judge can't make them build a jail. But what they can do is say you can't house humans here
did in California.
Yeah, and the citizens of Nowata can decide if they want to pay big bucks to because when you start farming out your prisoners, you have to transport whatever private facility in Oklahoma may have space. They're going to have to pay a per diem. Then they're going to have to move those prisoners back and forth for courts and for things. So it's a very expensive proposition, but that may be what it takes to force them to build a jail. But the judge can't make them build them. He just say you can't house people here. Those federal civil rights claims usually take some time.
Yeah, I remember like when I first started my adventure, that's when the California stuff was going through where they had 700 people living in a gymnasium, some ridiculous number. And there was a sock problem. They did not have enough socks to give out to people. So people would steal socks off the front of your bunk. And so you wouldn't send them off to the laundry. You would just wash them in the sink and then hang them on the end of your bunk. And then people would just steal your socks.
Pretty funny.
Oh my God, that's amazing. And of course, you know, these are the hardened criminals. These are like the Grand Theft Auto kind of people. And you're like, hey, these people have to stay locked up.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
And another article from The Appeal is Albany police shot a teen in the back and paralyzed him. The DA said it was justified. So I think that if you run away from the police, they have the right to shoot you.
I don't see a problem with it. Let's go into the next article.
All right, next. And now, look, before anybody tries to take this little clip, Andy said, no, that's not true. This is absolutely ludicrous that you could shoot someone, put a bullet in their back, lodge it somewhere in their spine, and they're paralyzed from the waist down or the chest down. And how can there not be consequences for that?
Well, the prosecutors are in a tough position, and I hate to defend prosecutors very often. But if you've watched, we had a verdict of not guilty just the last couple of days of this week and a police death. It's tough to gain a conviction over a police officer, to find a jury that will convict an officer, because the citizens give them so much deference. But we don't need to let it get to that point. You've heard me harp for I don't know how many episodes about we need to take control of the police in terms of what weapons we allow them to use, what the rules of engagement are, how we allow them to police. This is the only occupation that I know where the employers are dictated by the employees about how they conduct their job.
Right.
I mean, it's really quite bizarre. We get to decide what the policies are. And the police get to work and carry the equipment that we allow them to carry. They get to engage people with the rules that we allow them to engage people. And they get to fire at people if we allow them to do that under very restrained rules, not officer discretion. And if you don't like those rules, you have the same choice that the judges have in Otero County. You can choose not to be a police officer. And if we can't fill the police officer slots, then we will rethink our rules. But I don't think we'll have any problem with good police practices, because we'll have less animosity with the police. We'll have more community involvement with the police. We will have trust in the police, and we'll have solvability of crimes. The crime solved will go up exponentially, and we will actually have a safer community if we actually would take control of our police departments. But what you see here is a police department out of control.
Did you send me the little clip of the guy that was handcuffed to a chair and the cops were punching him in the face? Or did I find that one on my own?
I think you found it, or another listener sent it. But good, I don't grief. What's your problem with that?
I know. You could be spitting on the police, and they did show some clips of the guy in the chair spitting on the police, and I appreciate that. And there are charges on the books of, like, you know, projectile human fluid or something like that. So you've got charged, but man, so he spit and two officers started punching him in the face, and they did get charged and I'm pretty sure convicted, but like, I don't think that's what the police are supposed to do.
So I don't think so either, but it's only the Department of Justice was under the previous administration was being very active and trying to rein in police. They tried to curtail the amount of equipment that they were getting from the military. And they were going and investigating police agencies across the country and challenging them on their practices. But this administration has turned all that back. And there's rumor that they're even going to relieve the departments that have agreed to consent orders, what they call a consent decree, that they're going to let those agencies out. And I have not seen anything other than rumor. So I'm not saying that the consent decrees are going to be revoked tomorrow. But that's
what's the consent decree?
Where parties agree to make changes. So when these police agencies get under the DOJ's microscope, they end up with a consent decree all over the country. We have one here in Albuquerque where the police were just shooting so many people because of their bad practices. So, you know, the rules of engagement that allowed them to, there's people that you can't imagine that they shot that were ruled justified. Yeah. And the one case where the prosecutor had the audacity to prosecute the Boyd case, the jury found a deadlock, and then the special prosecutor decided it wasn't going to try it again, wasn't going to try the case again because there was no hope of gaining conviction. But these things are tough because the citizens don't see there any problem with it.
Right.
If you go out and take your poll and ask people if the cop shot someone in the back, do you have a problem with it? Our little snarky playfulness we were doing, most people would agree with that. They'd say, well, they shouldn't have been running from the cops.
Right.
They didn't have anything to hide. Obviously, they had some kind of, they must have been doing something really bad. That's why they're running. And so the cop was keeping us safe by shooting them in the back. No telling what they were up to.
Right. This article comes from the Santa Fe New Mexican. Bill before governor gives sex abuse victims more time to seek justice. I think this is in your backyard, Larry. You probably can speak pretty much as a voice of authority on this particular subject.
I can and I will. This is a bill that is all but destined to be signed, Senate Bill 55. And it's been something that they're pushing across the country to lengthen the statute of limitations or abolish it. And this was on the criminal side. It was introduced as a bill that would remove the statute of limitations for any crime against a minor for a sexual offense or child abuse. And as the bill went through the process, it got amended several times, and it's less bad now, the one the governor's going to get to sign. And I believe it's very certain that she will sign it. But the bill as it stands was a dramatic improvement from our perspective, because going from no statute of limitations is what the proponents want. We ended up with raising the statute of limitations to only age 30. And age 30 is a 6-year increase from the present statute, because now the statute runs 6 years from when they turn 18. So now it's going to run 12 years from when they turn 18. And then it narrowed the universe of offenses down to criminal sexual penetration, and it dropped the criminal sexual contact and the child abuse. So we've got a narrower universe of offenses, and we've got a shorter period of time. 30 is still pretty old. If someone's 9 and they allege something, you've got 21 years. So but you'll have to admit that it's better than what we could have had. Ask the people in Illinois and other states where they've just abolished the statute of limitations altogether. I mean, we consider it a major victory to contain the damage to this level. But these people won't stop. They'll come back in future sessions, and they'll want to raise it to higher and higher. And without any advocates there on the other side, they will succeed.
And so as something like this is going through, how many different times do you have to try and derail it, roadblock it, stop it, whatever? How many different opportunities are there throughout the process?
Well, it depends on the state and their process. Our processes here are make it more likely to be able to alter legislation, because we assign bills to multiple committees. So often you see a bill introduced, and if it's introduced in the House of Representatives, it'll get assigned to one House committee. In this state, if it gets introduced as a House bill, it's going to be assigned to two House committees, and possibly three, but almost always two. And then if it makes it through that process and gets a full approval of the House and gets introduced in the Senate, it's going to get assigned to two more committees on that side. So this started out as a Senate bill. So it had to go through that process of two Senate committees, Senate floor. Then it had to go through the House, and it got amended in the Senate, and the Senate Judiciary Committee. And then it got voted out of the Senate. They had lowered the age to 35. Then it goes over to the House, and they do some more work on it. It gets amended in the second committee, which happened to be the House Judiciary Committee. And then the House voted it out. Then it had to go back to the Senate to be concurred with, because it was not the same bill that left the Senate. So it had to go back to the Senate for concurrence.
This is one of the things that I was sort of trying to bring up before with the Stacey Abrams thing. In a case like this, you could then say so-and-so voted against removing the statute of limitations because they didn't like the bill that only increased it to 30, but they wanted to make it just, in perpetuity. You could then twist the words around and say the person voted against it because it wasn't what they wanted, and they chose to vote for nothing versus something along the way.
Could say that didn't happen in this case. Once
no, I know, I know. I'm just trying to use this as like an outline for where things get twisted and where people then get vote against. I'm sort of changing subjects a little bit, but that's where this is kind of like the subject that I was going after when I was talking about Stacey Abrams.
Well, you could happen, or it could be an amendment. Somebody could vote against the amendment. You can put spin on everything. The average voter is not going to stand all that spin.
Right.
The average voter is going to do one or two things. They're either going to tune out, or they're going to vote according to what their beliefs are. If they believe Democrats are bad, they're going to vote against them. If they believe Republicans are bad, they're going to vote against them. Average person, there's too many transactions that go on in the legislature for the average person to have the time or the expertise to follow it. You'd have to have a great deal of knowledge more than the average person has to dissect all of what's going on. And you have to understand the process. And it's not things that most people understand. So you can put bad spin on it. You can make someone look bad. And that's what happens in politics when you're trying to get elected. You can either try to run on what you want to do, or you can make the other person look bad. And it seems like in this country that more and more running, tearing another person down seems to be more and more the way to go.
So here we go. Here's another state that has reduced the statute of increased the statute of limitations. Increase the time. It's like you could word it from the front side or the back side, depending. Anyway. So here's another state that has done something similar to what Maryland did.
Well, Maryland has no statute. We're that kind of. Yep, forever. And it's been that way for all felonies in Maryland for a number of years.
Has it?
So, well, like Illinois, because of Hastert, former House Speaker Hastert, it's a nationwide phenomenon.
Yeah, yeah. And if it wasn't obvious sort of leading up to this, at the beginning of the show, I talked about Mike leaving us the happy comments, but Mike left a voicemail message that we're going to kind of use as the feature segment. But throughout the program, I've been kind of trying to pepper what I think would be questions that go along with what Mike is asking about how does the process of a bill move through the system. And so here's Mike's voicemail.
Hey guys, just wanted to call and leave a quick comment and one question. First comment is thank you guys for doing what you do. My charges are close to 30 years old, and I've been on the registry since the day it started, which was over 23 years ago in the great state of Florida. And for someone like me, do not like to use any kind of social media. I'd rather get my information direct and clear and not so much hearsay and hate speech as you hear on social media. So thank you guys for providing that platform. And my one question is for Larry. Larry, pretend I have never had any kind of education or any training on how a bill would be passed through the Senate and the House in the state of Florida. Could you give me a quick, easy to understand rundown on how a bill is introduced, how it goes through the process, and what it says when it's put into law, when it's actually made law? I would greatly appreciate it. I'm following several bills in the state of Florida and would just like to get that information. And last but not least, I really appreciate what you guys do. And a big old FYP to anybody who don't appreciate the podcast. I think you guys are great, and have a good weekend, and hope to hear you soon.
Hey, Larry, that's a 3 FYP episode, I think.
That's a three-peat. Trifecta.
And I know that Mike was a little bit vague. And Larry, it turns out that I emailed the wrong Mike to try and see if he would come on the show tonight. He is 100% willing to do it, and we'll have him on next week. But maybe we can start building the framework around what he's talking about and cover some basics. We can't?
We can.
I thought you said we can't. And then, you know, then Mike can feedback with some questions, and maybe we can have him on and try and go through some dialogue. This is a gigantic subject, though.
It is. And I touched on it a little bit with Senate Bill 55. I was talking about the statute of limitations. Well, the majority of the states have part-time legislatures, meaning these people, this is not their full-time occupation. Ours is the state that has no salary. They get a per day allowance of like $150 when they're in session, which will not cover your expenses for being in an expensive city like Santa Fe. But they don't have they don't have very much in the way of staff support. So legislation is typically brought to a lawmaker as an idea in some cases, or a specific proposal. Someone's already drafted up something. And since I think in maybe only one state, you can't introduce anything in the legislature. It has to be introduced by a lawmaker. I hear this stuff, well, the attorney general introduced it. No, the attorney general didn't introduce a damn thing. The attorney general found, the attorney general's office found a willing senator or representative to carry the legislation for them, but they didn't introduce anything. And so what happens is an idea is brought to a lawmaker, or a proposal that's already been written up in some form is brought to a lawmaker and asked, we need a law. In the case of the statute of limitations, it's the advocacy organizations who are advocating on behalf of victims who have been traumatized a long time ago and who have not had any redress of their grievances because the statute of limitations has expired and people can't be prosecuted. And they're saying this should not go on. And they find a willing lawmaker, or sometimes a group of lawmakers, and they draft up something. What you carry to the lawmaker is not usually the way it's introduced, because the bill is going to try to match the statutory language that's already in place, if there's already language. So they're going to try to draft it in conformance to how their statutes already read. So they have a legislative drafting service in every legislature. Here we call it the Legislative Council Service. Don't know what they call it in Florida, but they draft these things up and get them in fileable format to be introduced. And when they're introduced as legislation, they refer to that as jacketing the bill. So they'll put the sponsor's name on it, and it'll be assigned a bill number, and it's introduced into, if it's a House member of the House of Representatives, it'll be given a House bill number. Right. If it's a Senate bill, it'll be given a Senate bill number, and they usually start at one.
And if it's in Nebraska, they have some weird letter combination.
They call it LB because it's legislative bill. they don't have, but in most states, you're going to see an HB or an SB number, and they usually start at one. Some of the numbers are the early numbers are reserved. Like our House Bill 1 is always going to be what we call the feed bill. It is the appropriation to pay for the session. So House Bill 1 is always going to be the feed bill. House Bill 2 is always going to be the General Appropriations Act that funds most of the state government. So House Bill 1 and 2 have already been spoken for. So you're not going to get 1 or 2. If you go in and file something the first day they open pre-filing, you're not going to get that number. You're going to get House Bill 3 or more. but anyway, you'll get a number. What it's read on the floor. First reading is read on the floor. This is a proposal by Senator so-and-so, Representative so-and-so, having been read twice by title, and it gets referred to a committee, because in our session that just concluded, a 60-day session, we had 600-plus House bills and 600-plus Senate bills, and we had 60 days. So let's just say it's 1,300 bills. If you divide 1,300 divided by 60,
and you're probably only talking about working days too, right? You're not talking necessarily weekends too.
Calendar days. Ours. Yeah. We would have had the full legislature would have to consider 21 bills a day.
That's a lot of bills, man.
So that would mean you would take public testimony on 21 bills per day. Can't be done. Right. So what they do is, after it's introduced, they look at the subject matter and they assign it to an appropriate committee. And if you look on your legislative website, you'll see the list of standing committees. Almost everything related to criminal justice is going to be referred to something that's approximating a judiciary committee. In the Maryland Senate, they call it judicial proceedings, but in our state, they call it the judiciary committee. But it's going to in our state, since it's going to get two committee referrals, it will get the judiciary committee, and it'll get in the House, if it's a House bill, it'll get the House Consumer and Public Affairs Committee. And it may get the House Appropriations and Finance Committee as a third committee referral if it's going to have significant financial impact, in addition to the public policy aspect, in addition to the legal aspect. If it's going to have significant financial cost, it may get a third committee. Well, the order that it's going to be heard in those committees is assigned in our state by the leadership. So it's first to House Consumer and Public Affairs, and on Judiciary, and then on to Appropriation and Finance if it got a third committee. So those committee chairs decide when they're going to schedule public comment and debate on that bill. We are the only state I know where we actually debate the bill with the public watching, and they take a vote with the public watching after they've heard public comment. So they will actually, when they call the bill in committee, they'll say, this House Bill number 27. Is anybody here in the room in support of House Bill 27? Show of hands. 12 hands go up. And they say, oh, okay, anybody in opposition? 12 hands go up. They say, okay, we're going to take public comment, and we're going to limit you to 2 minutes each or 3 minutes each. And people start making their comments. And at the end of the comment, when there's no other comment, then the members will begin debate. At that point, the public no longer participates. They're not debating you. They're debating themselves. And they go into debate and talking about the pros and cons, about what they see as pros and cons, taking into consideration what was said. And they generally vote to either to advance it with a due pass recommendation, or they can make amendments to it and advance it with a due pass recommendation, or they can table it in our system, meaning that they just think it isn't fit to go any further. And there'll be a motion to table. And they'll actually take a vote right then to do one of those things. Now, in most of the other states, they go into the bowels of the Capitol somewhere at 3 o'clock in the morning with big fat cigars, and they take a vote later. And I'm over describing it because they actually probably hold most of the votes in public. But they go ahead and hear as many bills as they can, public comment, and then they go into another session and they have the debate. Well, we don't do it that way. We have the debate with your eyeballs who took the time to travel to the Capitol to see how the debate goes and what the outcome's going to be. The downside to that is that they might have 14 bills scheduled that day, and a lot of people showed up on 7 of the bills, and that kills all the time they've got. And the 7 other people bills that were scheduled, they have to say, we're really sorry, we're not going to get to these bills today. We really appreciate you guys traveling and coming up, but we're going to have to roll these over. And they get rescheduled for another day. And then you get pissed off because it's some giant conspiracy that they did to silence public comment. And it was no conspiracy at all. They actually had the public comment, and there was too much of it. and they didn't get to as many bills on the schedule. But in other states, they usually try to hear the bills, and then they have the debate, and they vote later. But it will move through the committee process. So he would need to find out in Florida how many committees does a bill typically get signed to. What's going to happen in committee is going to be what largely determines how successful that bill is. What were you about to ask?
Well, I even wanted to like roll back. He said there are, I think he said 3 bills, maybe he said 4, maybe he said 2 bills that he's currently following. Aren't the state legislative sessions over?
Some are, some are not.
I'm thinking now that I'm thinking about it. So Florida being kind of a pretty ginormous state, that they probably have year round legislation. Or
I don't know if they do have year-round, but we can take a quick look. But some run year-round, and some have much longer sessions. We have one of the shorter sessions of the country. But he needs to figure out, by looking at the legislative website, the bill numbers, it should tell them what committee that they've been assigned to or what group of committees they've been assigned to. And the chair of those committees are so important because – they control the calendar. And I say this and people roll their eyes and they get frustrated, but the majority party gets to have all the chairs.
Right.
That means the person who's referred to as Madam Chair or Mr. Chair is going to be the majority party. So in the case of Florida, last time I looked, it was heavily Republican. So all the committee chairs are going to be Republicans, and they're going to have the majority of the members in proportion to their ratio. So if they have 70% of the seats in the House, they're going to have 70. If there's a 70, 100 members of the House of Representatives in Florida, and the Republicans have 70 of those seats, the ratio in the committees is going to be about 70%. So if it's right. A 20 member committee, they're going to have at least 14 of the seats. So you've got 14 Democrats, 14 Republicans and 6 Democrats on the committee.
And to use an extreme example of controlling the calendar, Mitch McConnell not bringing Merrick Garland to the floor, that he had the control to do that. It was a dick move, but he had the control to do that.
Under the rules, it was unprecedented, but he had the majority being in leadership, all he would have had to have done is told, I believe, Chairman Grassley from Iowa that it'd be really nice if we didn't have any hearings on Garland. And Grassley would have said, yes, sir. Because if Grassley had said, no, sir, the chairmanships are assigned by the leadership, and you can find yourself quickly out in the, with your office assignment redone, and you can find yourself not chairing anything, and you can find yourself stripped of your committees.
Didn't they do that to somebody? Somebody made some really atrocious comment, and then they I can't think of his name. He made some pretty horrible racist statements, and they stripped him of everything. I think
it happens all throughout the ages. Willie Brown, when he was in California, he got stripped. He ultimately came back, became speaker, but they had him basically in a broom closet because they were teaching him a lesson. So McConnell would have been able to have, and he did not, he would have, he was able to make sure that there were no committee hearings held to confirm Garland. It was unprecedented, but he had the power. And just because you have the power doesn't mean it's the right thing to do. It just means it's the constitutional thing to do. And I tell people, just because something is constitutional doesn't make it right. Just because we don't like something, that doesn't make it unconstitutional.
And I only wanted to bring that up because I would imagine many people would have at least heard grumblings about that whole thing. Something going on in your little local state house, you know, some sort of insignificant bill, you're not going to hear about these things being pushed off and so forth. But that is just my example of showing where controlling the calendar and so forth, you have that control over what gets heard and what doesn't.
Absolutely. Bills can die an agonizing death in committee if the chairperson of the committee doesn't want that bill to move. But let's just say the bill does move. Let's say it gets one committee assignment in the Florida House. It's a House bill, and it gets assigned to the Judiciary Committee, and they give it a do pass. Then it's going to go to the floor of the House, where more likely than not, it's going to pass because the committee that's entrusted with having the expertise has reviewed it and said it's good legislation.
Because the people controlling the farm bill don't necessarily know about the criminal justice stuff and vice versa, so they just go along with what the committee, unless they have some sort of insight or whatever expertise in it, but they're going to go along with what the committee said because they're the experts.
That's generally the rule. Now, things do. We can talk about a bill that fell on the floor here. There's a few that fell on the floor. But as a normal, everyday bill, if it gets past the committee or committees that it's been assigned to, there's a very good chance it's going to pass on the floor. There's a such thing as amending bills on the floor. The floor amendments can be done. So if something does get out of committee and you feel really strongly about it, then you need to get to your member of that chamber and say, I'd like to see a floor amendment done. And they'll look at you like you rolled your eyes, and they'll realize that you actually know a little bit about what you're talking about and say, this is bad. Here's why. And specifically, to make it better, we need to do a floor amendment. And that can be done on the floor. Amendments can be done. They can actually even substitute the bill on the floor. That's even less common, but it can be done, and the bill can be changed. But once it, say hypothetically, that House bill passes the House, then it's going to move over to the other side of the rotunda, if they have a round capital, and it's going to go through the same process as it went through. It's going to be assigned to one or more committees, and it's going to go through another vetting with the other side. To the other side of the rotunda. It would be just flip it over. If it started as a Senate bill, it's going to come over to the House side. If it's a House bill, it's going to go over to the Senate side. An identical bill has to pass both sides of the rotunda. And there's processes if the bills change to reconcile those bills. The first process is if like I said, if our Senate bill 55, it got changed in the House. So once the House made amendments to it, then it had to go back to the Senate. And the first step was to go back to the Senate and say, do you like these amendments that the House did? And the sponsor in the Senate said, absolutely. I'm not going to risk my bill dying. So I'll urge my members to concur with it. That's the first step. If they concur, that ends the inquiry. If they don't concur, if they reject the amendments, then the amending chamber is asked if they will recede on the amendment. So you would send if the Senate sponsor of Bill 55 had said, I don't like the amendments, then the House would be asked if they would like to recede. And if the House refuses to recede, they say, we're sticking with our amendments. Then you've got the need to have a conference at that point, because you've got two different versions of the bill. You've got the Senate bill as it left the Senate. You've got the House bill, and you have to go into conference and see if you can work it out. And this is where it gets really complicated to the people, because they think something sinister happens when Bills goes to conference. When you go to conference, you get representatives of the Senate and representatives of the House. They hammer out an agreement, and the only vote you get as a member is to accept the recommendations or reject them. There's no friendly amendments once the conferees come to an agreement. You can debate till you're blue in the face, but there's no more changes. This is the deal. So they usually take a voice vote to approve the report of the conferees. And people think there's something sinister about that, and there's nothing sinister. It's the way the system works. If you try to change it, then you undo the work of the conferees, and the whole process dies.
I think we should leave it there. My eyes are starting to roll in the back of my head.
Well, that's why I was telling you that when he comes on, we can get more specific. If he can have some bill numbers and tell us where they are in the process, maybe he can investigate how the legislation is assigned in Florida and give us some more specifics. But I gave you some broad generalities of how things move through legislative processes. And ours is designed to make sure that bad things don't get through.
But they do get through.
They do get through. But it's designed to try to prevent bad things. Also, good things don't get through.
Right.
Because it's designed to be a very deliberate process. A bad bill almost got through having to do with towing vehicles.
Oh, we might have to hear a story about that at some point.
Yes, and we can have that story. But yes, a bad bill almost got through, and I was able to assist in the process. And once they realized how bad it was, it did not get through.
Well, Larry, how can people find us and get in touch with us?
They have a whole plethora of mechanisms to reach us.
Plethora? You're bringing out the 50 cent words.
Yes, there's a plethora. And I would prefer, we had such good quality calls. I would prefer that they reach the way that we had three tonight, the trifecta, by calling 747-227-4477. And if you didn't get that number, you can hit pause and replay, right, Andy?
Yes, if you're listening. Well, yeah, regardless, it's not live radio, so you could totally hit pause. Why don't you go find a podcast app and click, search for Registry Matters and click download, and then it just shows up on your phone. I don't understand why everyone doesn't do this. This makes the most sense to me.
But if you want to find us, I think we're at registrymatters.co.
Ooh, CO, huh?
And you can sign up to be notified, right? You can subscribe to Registry Matters podcasts.
Yes, you will get an email message coming out that when the episode is released, generally at 11:59 on Monday night.
And if you would like to do the high tech communication and send us a question, you can do that at registrymatterscast@gmail.com.
What is the absolute best way to support the podcast?
Well, I'm disappointed no one has taken us up on this one, but
it's really sad. If no one, how about this? If no one takes us up on that deal by the end of the year, how about we just shut the whole thing down?
So it's you can become a patron, and how do they do that? They go to patreon.com. And how do you spell Patreon? Just to make sure that people are able to find us.
P-A-T. So Patreon. P-A-T-R-E-O-N.
.com.
Yes.
/ Registry Matters.
We are Registry Matters everywhere.
And you, we're encouraging people to, let's see, we said the gross pay and then nobody did that. Then we said net pay and no one's done that. So
maybe people should send us winning lottery tickets.
Or on a serious note, any amount as little as a dollar per month, it deducts automatically and it doesn't charge you the fee it charges you the dollar, but it doesn't charge you any fee that comes out of our side.
It does. They charge us some handling and maintenance fees and so forth.
So a dollar a month would be fantastic. We're trying to reach 100 patrons by the end of the year.
And lastly, we have this Discord thing, and there's a question in Discord tonight. We have like a whole bunch of people listening in over on Discord. We even have Brenda's over there from Narsil, the ED from Narsil. But there's a question, and it's totally directed at you, Larry. Are you ready for an impromptu question?
I reckon so.
All right. It says, ask Larry what jail conditions were like at the turn of the century.
Well, in some ways they were better because we didn't have as many people. back then in jails, and there was a lot more lax in terms of, you look at old Western shows, how they let people come in and have contact visits, and they could hug and they could bring food, and it was.
And we're talking about the 19th century. We're talking about the turn from 18 to 1900, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Back in those days, gotcha. If you look at Gunsmoke and how the jails were back in Festus's days, that security wasn't like it is today, and so in some ways it was better in terms of how the inmates were treated, and the access to head of the families. In some ways it was worse because the facilities were not so good. But then again, the facilities everybody lived in weren't so good in those days. So I guess when you compared it to what everyone lived like in the cabins without plumbing, I guess it was comparable.
All right.
I don't remember because we've had running water and plumbing for the majority of my life. I mean, we started having plumbing in the early 1900s in cities, and I just can't remember back in the Lincoln days as well as I wish I could.
Well, yeah, it was a while ago.
It was. But I can remember that telegraph thingy where they were going ding 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 though.
Do you know Morse code, Larry? I assume you don't know Morse code.
I don't, but I remember that they paid people to make clicks on the telegraph.
Absolutely. All right, let's get out of here before we get completely stupid. I appreciate it as always, Larry. Have a great night, and I will talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks, Andy.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us here at FYP, and we hope you will join us again on our next broadcast.